All right, let's just do, I think today we'll just do the refuge and bodhicitta prayer rather than doing all the prayers that we've been doing. That's on page 98. I think most of you were here this morning, so already did a few prayers for the day. So we'll just begin with reciting refuge and bodhicitta once in English and then twice in the Tibetan. Again, page 98. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. Sangye chodang soki choknam la jangchu bardu dakni kyabsu chi daki chunyan gipe sonam gi drola penchir sangye drupar shok sangye chodang soki choknam la jangchu bardu dakni kyabsu chi daki chunyan gipe sonam gi drola penchir sangye drupar shog. Let's just do a short reflection, give ourselves a chance to adjust our motivation again. So just to find a comfortable posture, we'll just do a couple of minutes of focused meditation on the breath. So in doing this, we just bring our awareness to whatever feature of the breath that you want to pay attention to, and I'll suggest working once more with this point at the tip of the nose, where you feel the sensation of the air coming in the nostrils and then going back out the nostrils as you inhale, as you exhale. Just try to keep your awareness there as best as you can, kind of like a guard or a sentinel posted there at that station of the tip of the nose. Not following the breath in or following the breath out, but rather staying, you know, stationary there with that sensation. But then when the mind wanders, when you see that that happens, then simply notice that the mind has done that and bring the awareness back to the breath. So we'll do this in silence after I ring the chime for just a few minutes, and then I'll lead you in a short reflection. Now let's set our motivation. And yesterday we talked about having the most skillful intention or thoughts this being one of the Eightfold Path. And so we talked about these two different minds, the preliminary one that is the mind of renunciation, which is really a key part of our having a skillful intention. So with this first mind, what we're doing is, again, having that cognizance of what the Buddha taught in the Four Noble Truths, having the understanding that first what we are engaged in is an unsatisfactory state, what the Buddha called dukkha, which we translate as suffering, but includes all of our experiences, the fact that we are under the control of our karma and our delusions, going from life to life, always subject to some level of dissatisfaction. And then the second noble truth, that the factors that are inducing this circling from life to life are within our own minds. Our delusions, especially the root of ignorance, and then all of the karma that we create that's contaminated by that ignorance. These factors are causes that we ourselves produce. And this is why we are in this state of dukkha, of suffering. And then in the last two truths, we reflect on the fact that it doesn't have to be this way, that while this has been going on, the Buddha says, since beginningless time, we can actually have an end to our suffering. That's the third noble truth. Cessation of all of our suffering, all the causes of our suffering, is possible, is attainable. And how can it be attained? The fourth noble truth, the truth of the path that leads to the end of our suffering. And this is what we're studying over the course of this weekend, is one presentation of the Buddhist path that leads to the end of suffering, the attainment of nirvana, peace. So generate that motivation of renunciation that is wanting to turn away from suffering and its causes and turn towards liberation, freedom. Genuinely wanting this for yourself, as I said yesterday, this is self-compassion. This is wanting you to know that experience of complete pacification of all these factors in your own mind, everything that gives rise to your own suffering. That's our first level of motivation. And then the second level, this concept we call bodhicitta, the mind of awakening, the heart of awakening, where we recognize that we're not unique in our circumstance. In fact, every other being is in the same predicament we find ourselves in, under the control of these factors, going from life to life, experiencing dukkha. And every one of these beings has the potential to be liberated from that suffering, has the potential to achieve their greatest welfare. So here, out of love and compassion for these beings, wanting them to have true happiness, wanting them to not suffer, we generate the mind that is intent upon helping them to accomplish that, specifically by becoming enlightened ourselves, by becoming a Buddha, going beyond our own individual liberation to attain the state of complete enlightenment, Buddhahood. The result that entails are having perfected our minds, developed all of our qualities, removed all of our obscurations and negative tendencies, so that we will then be in the best position to help others to achieve that same state. And try to advance your motivation to that second level. It encompasses your own welfare, definitely. But moreover, by having that thought, that bodhicitta intention, you can then benefit all sentient beings and attain a state that will allow you to do that. Okay, so I had, at the end of yesterday's teachings, I had mentioned possibility of talking about speech during the morning session, but I didn't do that. So you if you weren't here, you didn't miss any of the eightfold path that I'm going to go through. So we will have to abbreviate some of our investigation of some of these because we've got about a little over 2 hours now to go through the remaining material. We're on page 2 of the black and white sheets. Again, to get rooted in where we are, using the colored sheet that you have with the wheel, we have gone through the first two that are the yellow spokes of the wheel, right view and right intention, or skillful view and intention. These are part of our training in wisdom. And on those, you know, first sheet of the black and white sheets, we looked at all the topics that kind of inform our correct view, or our world view, according to what the Buddha taught, as well as how that channels then into some very skillful positive intention. Both of those minds that we just meditated on, renunciation and bodhicitta in particular. But all of it entails just moving away from what is causing suffering and is negative in nature to what produces happiness, what is positive in nature. So now we actually have the foundation for developing a good understanding of morality, which on the colored sheet is the blue section there of the wheel. It includes, I'm sorry, green, not colorblind, I just read the wrong color. The higher training of morality, which are the three green spokes there of right speech, right action, and right livelihood. And I gave a little context for that yesterday in terms of talking about karma and the fundamental principles that guide how karma works. And I'm not going to review that because, again, we do need to delve back into the material. But any questions up to this point then in terms of what we've looked at? All right. Let's go ahead and take a look at right speech then. You know, right speech. Speech and our actions, which are the second of these, as well as our thoughts, are said to be the three doors. They're the three ways that we are kind of creating karma and that we are interacting with the world, as well as certainly formulating how we interact with the world. We already looked at thoughts in terms of, you know, our mind. Speech and our way of communicating with others is a key part. I mentioned this a little bit earlier today, of how we actually engage with other beings. I'd say it's probably the main way that we engage with others. We don't have as many physical opportunities. We're embodied, so we're all here in our physical bodies, but we really are mostly about connecting with others through our speech. So having correct or skillful speech, as it says on that sheet on page 2, entails cultivating less harmful and more helpful communication, which is a product of our right understanding and intention. It includes particularly the following topics. So again, none of these topics on the eight-spoked wheel, none of these eightfold designations are separate from each other. They're all interconnected. They're all fed by each other, and we could see them once more, as was described yesterday, as a spiral rather than as, you know, something that is quite distinct. So with right speech, it's kind of interesting, the terminology that is used there on that page, seeing morality as aids to mental purification. Right speech is the first of these three that have to do with morality. This phrasing of aids to mental purification actually comes from Bhikkhu Bodhi's book on the Eightfold Path. And it's kind of an interesting way to think about it, that what we're trying to do on our Buddhist path is essentially purify our minds and replace all of the negative states with everything that is wholesome and positive. So in a sense, we can say that our morality, how we are engaged in the world, is an aid to that process. And we do tend to sometimes think that all these things, particularly when we get to livelihood, that somehow that's separate from our spiritual path. But the reality is everything is connected. If we are to be beings that are dedicated to these correct thoughts that we talked about, living a life of renunciation and bodhicitta, then that should play out in terms of what we say, how we are with others physically, how we are with others in terms of our livelihood and the ways that we go about having livelihood in this world. So this is an interesting term. I just threw it out there as part of the sheet there because you don't usually hear about, you know, morality as an aid to mental purification, maybe in those words, but it's right in line with the concepts that we always practice in this tradition. So as it says there in that description, having examined our thoughts and intentions through our correct understanding and right intentions or view, we now, or how we act, speak, and make our livelihood in the world reinforces the changes in our minds. So it's, once more, everything is grist for the mill if we really use it in that way. Your livelihood should be an extension of your spiritual practice. You're talking to others, whether it be friends or people at work or whatever the case might be, should always be an aid to the spiritual path that you're practicing. So what does unskillful speaking and communication look like? Well, this is very common to what most of you who studied this tradition know. These are four of what are called the 10 non-virtuous actions, which are rooted in the Buddha's fundamental teachings about morality. And they aren't meant to be seen like the 10 commandments, like the Buddha coming down from on high and saying, thou shalt not, but rather that these are the Buddha's observations on what leads to suffering so we can avoid it and adopt the opposite of those so that we actually have the causes of happiness. It's rooted in a complete understanding of getting the causes in place that will lead to the results that we want and avoiding those that lead to the opposite. So as it says there, we want to avoid those verbal actions or other ways of communication that diminish the quality of our relationships with others. This is a nice way to put this, right? I mean, sometimes we don't think about our verbal communications with others in that way, but if we're very skillful in how we talk to others and what we communicate, what we say, how we say it, and so on, then we will create much more beneficial relationships with others. We'll see that in terms of our ability to work with others, to be in harmony with them, and so on. So these four are commonly set out again as the fourth through the seventh of the 10 non-virtues. They are speaking to deceive, which is another way of talking about lying. It's when we intentionally, through our communication, want to deceive others, make them think something that is not true. You might think, well, why would we do that? Well, we do that for a lot of reasons, obviously, because we need to protect maybe our ego and our sense of, you know, knowing more than we do or whatever, and we don't want to admit to faults in our own personality or to having done things that were not so skillful. So we frequently engage in this type of behavior, speaking to deceive. We also do the second one, which we call divisive speech in our presentations usually, which is speaking to cause conflict in relationships. You know, I think we have to be rather broad in how we look at this because we do this in a lot of ways that we're not so, maybe we don't have that premeditation to it, but we create patterns that continue divisions in our world. Divisions between political parties, divisions between genders, division between a variety of things that we have in the world that can, we feed it frequently in very subtle ways. So this is a very hard one to, I think, completely do away with. In the more overt ways, when we're like actually saying something to somebody, say we have a friend and we don't like the person that they're dating. And so we'll like start saying things to our friend to make them think that they shouldn't be with that person because we don't like that person. Well, this is divisive speech. This is trying to create disharmony between people who may be getting along just fine. Maybe that person, though we don't like them, they're totally in love with them. Or maybe there's already a division between people and we further it by continuing to feed the flames of that division. The third one, speaking to offend or harm, this is what we frequently call harsh speech. This, of course, is one of the more problematic ones, because if we use our speech in a very negative way like that, our cutting words, harsh words, it doesn't mean that we always are going to sound kind of kind and smooth and gentle. I'm just getting Venerable Rabina in here, and you'll know that she's speaking very beneficially, but not always without, you know, that level of a tone or whatever. We sometimes do have times when we use what might sound like harsh speech. We always want to make sure that our speech is quite meaningful and purposeful, and if it has to be couched inside of a little bit more direct tone. For example, even, I won't talk about Venerable Rabina, but we could talk about if you're raising a child, a very young child, right? And say that child is getting ready to, you have a candle in a place where maybe it's not supposed to be, so that the child sees the flame and starts going towards the flame with their little hand. You wouldn't sit there and go, oh no, dear, don't touch that. right? You know, you'd want to be really forceful. Because if the child's getting very close to touching that flame, you're going to have to say something that sounds quite harsh to get them to pull their hand away. But why are you doing that? Not because you hate the child or want to punish the child. You're doing it because you care about the child, that you're having compassion for them and not wanting them to suffer. So again, we have to understand that harsh speech, sometimes we may hear things that sound like harsh speech. And that even happens at Venerable Rabina's teaching sometimes, right? Where you might hear her talking to somebody, but she's trying to actually be very skillful in helping people to confront some things that they might be looking at. We may not have that skill. I think she does, but you know, that's up to each of us to kind of look at our own speech and decide what level we can use in terms of helping others to address these issues in their lives. But to have an awareness that when we are doing it with a negative intention, where our intention is to harm or to offend others, this is not so skillful. And we know this from being on the receiving end of this, right? I didn't like growing up when my father would criticize me and say negative things about me, and I'd be like, oh, it's not so pleasant to hear. Maybe he meant some good by it, but frequently I don't think he did. So, the last one is interesting phrase in this way, speaking that wastes time. We often call this meaningless talk or idle talk in our tradition. This is the biggest problem on this list, I think, because we do a lot of this in our society, right? And I'm not saying that we can only talk about something meaningful and purposeful with everyone that we meet, because that's not going to happen either, right? You know, we do have to acknowledge that a part of our being in the world is to have casual conversations with people, get to know them, have some common points of identity and you know, recognizing things about others that aren't all about a spiritual path necessarily. But to the extent that we get caught up in that and spend hours and hours doing that, chatting on the phone forever, or even, once more, this is any type of communication. We use speech because at the time of the Buddha, they didn't text each other, right? You know, they weren't doing all these other ways of communicating. They didn't even have much writing, per se. It wasn't like people wrote letters to each other necessarily. There was some of that, but there wasn't the degree that we have in our society of communication through so many different means. This can even be body language. This can even be speaking by omission for some of these, for lying, for example. We can deceive others by just kind of not doing anything, right? Shrugging our shoulders. Who took that last cookie? You know, you don't say anything, but you lied because you didn't answer the question. You kind of gave the appearance like, I don't know. So again, with speaking that waste time, what we're talking about there is any way that we get caught up in kind of communications that are frivolous, meaningless, that we just get attached to. We create that type of pattern. Why this is one of the worst is because it's habitual, where we just talk and talk and talk and spend all kinds of hours doing things that are really not so useful. So I think it's good to, you know, really have some awareness of these four and then to adopt, as it says there, the more skillful ways of speaking and communicating. These are what we want to adopt that because they improve the quality of our relationships with others. And they're, in a sense, the opposites of these. Speaking the truth. I mean, always having that be our guideline, to speak the truth. Now, I know people will say, well, but there's situations where, say, you know that somebody is having an affair and their partner asks you, are they having an affair, and you don't want to lie, you want to tell them the truth because you don't want to upset them. Or people ask me these sorts of questions, and I'm like going, well, I think each of those situations we may have to look at. And once more, what is our motivation? I mean, I think it is definitely possible to lie with a good motivation, but we have to be really clear about what that motivation is. His Holiness says, even in one of his teachings, it's in the book that he, Flash of Lightning in the Dark, I think is where I found that he was talking about if you were out in the woods and you see a deer go bounding past you, you know, just goes off into the woods, and then you see a hunter coming right behind the deer saying, did you see the deer I'm hunting? And you're like, nope, didn't see any deer. But if you're only thinking about compassion for the deer, your compassion isn't really complete, right? Because you're also wanting to think about the compassion for the hunter who's going to kill the deer. And so then you make a decision to lie in that situation, or to, you know, not give that information away about where the deer went, because you have compassion for everyone involved in the situation. So there are instances, as Holiness points out, particularly when we're on the Mahayana path, the Bodhisattva path, where we can engage in some of these negativities if our motivation is quite clear. But we have to be really checking up on that. Don't go around thinking, oh yeah, it was quite clear, but you never really even thought about it. You just thought you were doing fine. If you're lying to your friend about them having an affair with somebody else, well then you need to think about why you're doing it. Is that in the best interest of that person and the person that they're involved in? Are you doing it out of a real sense of compassion, or do you simply not want to get involved? Yeah, and I think that we have to be very skillful in how we work with this. Sometimes when somebody tells you something, can I tell you something that you can't tell anybody else? Maybe the best answer is to say, no, you can't. Please don't. You know, that's, I hate to be that type of friend to people sometimes, but that may be the best answer, because you might be in a position where you have to, are asked to reveal that, and then you're trying to not break a promise to one person that you said you wouldn't reveal it to, and then the other person that wants to know that. So, speaking the truth, speaking to promote friendship and harmony, you know, saying good things about others. So say you don't like that person that that friend of yours is dating. Well, you might still say some nice things about that person to them. Why point out all their faults? Why, you know, try to create division between those people? Rather try to increase whatever that person is feeling towards that person they're dating, to have that be nurtured and strengthened, as opposed to completely ruined by your trying to divide them. Speaking kindly and gently, again, within the context of this is the preferred way that we communicate with each other, rather than yelling at each other all the time and saying, you know, profanities, but rather we speak from kindness, from gentleness. And then finally, speaking purposefully. If we can't make sure that all the words that we say have great purpose, at least have great purpose in our minds as to when we're engaging in that type of conversation. You know, I'll talk to my mom generally at least once a week, and sometimes she'll go on about a lot of different things, and I kind of like go along with her, try not to feed some of her discontentment at the neighbors or at this other person or whoever it is that she's talking about. But, you know, I think we have to acknowledge that's part of being in the world, but we keep our intention pure that we want to maintain harmony with other people and support them in whatever ways that we can. We don't have to get carried away with idle chatter and, you know, that sort of thing. Any questions on right speech? I don't want to spend tons of time on each of these simply because we do have a fair amount to cover, but I will share one thing that Eric Kolvig, who I've mentioned a few times, who's there's a out on the internet, I think it's probably still out there, I found it years ago, some transcripts of a single night that he did in on each of the Eightfold Path. Apparently they've been studying it for many months in Albuquerque, and it was around 1998, 99, something like that, that he taught. And they're really nice summaries. They're really very good. And in his summary on skillful speech, he says, when it comes down to having skillful speech, he encourages you to have two questions that you ask yourself before you open your mouth. One is, what am I saying? Or what is it that I'm going to say? So you look at the content first, and you say, okay, what is it that I'm actually going to, the words come out of my mouth. Secondly, why am I saying it? And again, it goes back to that idea of our intention, because we really should have a very clear, positive intention. One of the thoughts that is conducive with what we looked at under right intention or skillful intention, the second step, for it to be meaningful and useful and beneficial and creating harmony and what have you. If we don't have a good intention behind what we're saying, then maybe it's best to keep our mouth shut. Out on the internet, there's so many of these quotes that are attributed to various people that are fake quotes, right, you know. And there's some that I'm not sure that the Buddha actually said, but this one is attributed to the Buddha, and it says, don't speak unless you can improve on silence. It's kind of a nice thought. I don't know if the Buddha said it or not, but sometimes silence is perfectly fine. I think in our culture we get really nervous around people who are silent. You know, you talk to somebody and they're just silent, and you're like, why aren't you saying something? But, you know, I think we have to be really measured in our speech. If we're going to say something, we make sure it's in line with all this. Make sure it is something that is increasing the positive atmosphere and qualities, rather than contributing to division, to deceit, to harm, what have you. So if there's no questions on right speech, correct speech, skillful speech, let's go ahead and move on to skillful action. having correct, and what, by the word, this word action is just the traditional word that's used. What we mean by action in this context, because we can say action is, in our studies, we usually mean mental action, verbal action, physical action, they're all action. But what we mean by action in this context is physical action, bodily action, what we do with our bodies. And having correct or skillful action entails cultivating less harmful and more helpful ways of physically interacting with the world, which is a product, once more, of right understanding and intention. And it includes, in particular, the following topics. First of all, what are set out as the unskillful actions in physical actions in the traditional teachings, part of what, again, I called the 10 non-virtuous actions previously, are the first three that are on this list. You have four bullet points there, right, under unskillful physical actions. The first three, and these are actually the first three of the 10 non-virtues, which are set out because it is said that the actions we engage in physically do have a greater power than those that we do verbally. Nonetheless, as I said, our verbal actions are how we are normally interacting with others, so it's good to pay a lot of attention to those for sure. Right action, physical action, entails avoiding these three: killing, which is taking the life or injuring others. We frequently don't talk about injuring others so much in the Tibetan Buddhist presentation, but obviously it's a part of the continuum. You know, when I was young, I hate to say what I did to bugs and things. Maybe I'll tell you one story. You have fireflies here, right? I think they're around. So in the summer, you'd see the fireflies, and I'd be out with my friends, and I'd pinch the tails off the fireflies when the fire end is lit, so it stays lit, and I'd put it, like, on my face to decorate my face or something. These poor little bugs. Got some weird karma there, I'm sure, that I've created. So, you know, I think it's important, again, that we understand that anything in that continuum, it may not be killing, that was certainly because the bug couldn't survive without its little tail, but anything that harms other beings, pulling the legs off of creatures, doing things that would harm the lives of others, we really have to be careful with that, that we don't engage in that sort of action. And why that's so is, and why that is actually the worst of these 10 non-virtues, is because just as we treasure our dear bodies, every being treasures their body in the same way. We might not think that about insects or something, that we don't really see the emotional effect of that. With mammals, we do, right? And even birds, you do have, if you harm that animal, you can frequently see, you know, some emotive response to that. But when it comes to a lot of creatures in the world, we don't really see it, and so we don't think that there's any treasuring of their life. But trust me, I mean, they do. Another thing I used to do when I was a kid was use my magnifying glass to, like, get little insects or something with the rays of the sun. If you get the heat on them, they take off, right? You know, they don't want to sit there and just, oh, just kill me. You know, they'll do everything they can to avoid harm. So why do they do that? Because they treasure their own bodies. Did you want to share something, Shane?
Yeah.
Just hold on 1 second. We'll get a microphone over there just so it can be, because this is being live streamed, and so to make sure that people know the question that's being asked, as well as in the room. Sometimes it's hard to hear, but
well, I may not want to ask it now.
No.
It might be a silly question, but as a relative newcomer to the Eightfold Path, one question is fishing.
Sure.
Fishing seems like something that I've grown up with, and it's a great opportunity to spend with my children and pass that on, but it just doesn't seem to fall into, respecting that animal, and
sure,
we wouldn't want it done to us. And so I sort of see how that, I may have the answer to my own question there. Second question is, an animal such as a snake, which I just had a pretty bad experience with in my garden.
Yeah.
And I had to do what I thought I had to do in that situation.
Sure.
How would you talk about those two things?
Yeah, inevitably when we talk about killing, all these sorts of issues come up around killing for sport, or even killing when we're threatened by a being. And even, I mean, the Buddha would say that some of the microbial things that we have in our systems are sentient beings, parasites and what have you, that would be, if you do get a parasitic infection, you obviously want to take something to remove it, because it can cause even up to death in many cases. So you have these threats to our life, as well as things that we do that seem somewhat not so bad or what have you, or everyone does them, what have you. The fishing one, I think you did answer your question yourself. I mean, hunting for sport or even taking the lives of animals for their meat is really part of the act of killing. Now, eating the meat from that is a different act, and people do emphasize that aspect of it. It doesn't mean that you're not complicit or involved in the killing of that animal, but you're much more distant from it when you're eating the meat. So say somebody fishes and gives you one of the fish and says, here, I got an extra fish and happy for you to have that. You can take that fish and maybe feel that you're not that involved in the killing of it, unless it was killed specifically for you and you asked for that person to get a fish for you. And if you kill it yourself, you're certainly very close. You're doing the act of killing. So we just have to measure that in terms of how close we want to be to that type of action. And many people in Buddhism make the decision to be vegetarian, but that shouldn't mean that we also don't acknowledge that there's many beings killed to produce vegetables. There's beings killed to do almost everything that we're involved in, to produce the clothes that we wear, the food that we eat, and so on. All of this, when you drive on the road, you're inevitably killing lots of insects and beings in the summer that are out there and on the freeway getting into your windshield and what have you. So it's impossible to live in this world and not be complicit in the harm of other beings to some degree. I always advise people just to treat it in kind of an evolutionary way, like look at your life now and say, is there something I could change to move away from being so close to killing, and then make decisions on that basis. So maybe you can say, well, I'm not going to intentionally kill any longer, but I'm still going to kill in those cases where I feel there's a threat or a danger or something that I do need to remove. Ideally, in even those situations where we feel a threat, we should want to protect that life. Nonetheless, there are going to be situations where we have to take the lives of beings. Now, somebody was just telling me a story. Was it you, Denise, that told me this story? Maybe it was with Renee and Susan about the center where they had the problem with the rats or something, or what was it?
Oh, that was me.
That was Donna, yeah. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, we had a visiting teacher here once a few years ago, and I don't recall for sure who it was, but he was talking about having been in a different center where they had a problem with rats in the kitchen, and the health department came out multiple times and gave them warnings and tried to work with them, and ultimately said, we're going to close you down if you don't get rid of the rats. And rather than killing them, everybody in the center got together and they did Tonglen practice, and the rats went away.
And Tonglen is a meditation I mentioned yesterday that's all about taking away the suffering of others, giving them your happiness. It's a practice of meditation on compassion and loving kindness. You know, sometimes things do change karmically because we change and the people involved change, but nonetheless, I heard a story as well. I mean, I'll tell you the other side with the potential for there to be a different response. And I wish I could always attribute these stories to who told them to me. Venerable Rabina is always going, who told you that? Who told you that? And I'm like, well, I have to think about it, but I can't even remember who told me this story, but there was a story about another center that we had in, I think, Australia or New Zealand that was infested with termites. You know, so the building's decaying. There's no way that the structure is going to be there over time if they allow it to continue. And they did try a lot of practices and things, and nothing was really, you know, affecting that. And what I heard was that they got the advice from Rinpoche at one point that it would be okay to do the extermination, but to do all of these various practices and prayers before doing it, to make sure that they were doing everything possible for these beings to help them out in their future life or wherever they end up. So I think in different cases, it's different responses. And so we have to be very flexible in our own minds and not sit there and think, well, this is going to go away by virtue of various things that I'm doing, when maybe you don't have the karma for that to really happen either. So I don't know. So I don't know if I can completely answer the question for you. I mean, in cases where you have a poisonous snake or a snake that will bite and inflict some potential for there to be great harm, if we can find a skillful way to remove that. I know there was a woman in Taos, where I teach up in New Mexico, that had a rattlesnake in her bedroom once that she found. And she very skillfully managed to find a big plastic bin that she put over the top, like upside down on top of it, trapped it inside there and was able to even get the lid from the bin underneath it to scoop them up into the bin and put them outside somewhere. I wouldn't do it. I'd call somebody else to do it probably that's a little more skillful than me, because I'm sure I'd get bit somewhere along the way. But I think we just have to try to find skillful answers to these questions. I know in Santa Fe we had mice. There's a lot of field mice in Santa Fe, and the mice actually made it into our center, which was in downtown Santa Fe, and they were all over the place. And we managed to find one of these high-frequency things that you can plug into the wall that I'm sure are not so pleasant for the mice to hear, but it doesn't kill them. They just leave because they don't like the sound of that. So if we can find ways to not kill beings, to avoid them being pests or problems, that's always preferable. And I think sometimes we just don't think that far. We just react immediately because we feel like we need to, and maybe there's a better way to think about it and say, could I do something different here? But if we have to do that, there's lots of things taught in this tradition, at least in Tibetan Buddhism, about mantras and things we can say for that animal and try to plant some seeds in the mind of that animal with the understanding that that consciousness that was with that being goes on to another life. So why not do something beneficial for that being once you have that in front of you? They have mantras even in the prayer books here for what you can recite over meat that you eat. And you can find them in the here on page 206. There's the Medicine Buddha mantra for blessing meat, the Buddha Miktukpa mantra, Milarepa's mantra, and then a real specific one for blessing meat on 206. So you can copy those down if you are a meat eater or whatever. I don't know. These questions do come up, and there's different points of view from different Buddhist teachers. One teacher I had actually said that when you eat meat, you're not involved in the killing of the animal, but you're actually part of a chain of stealing. And his logic was that that animal never offered their flesh to anybody, right? Even if it was raised by people and fed by people, it never consciously made that offering of, and so it's taking what is not offered. You took that meat of that being, and the person who killed that being, whether it was killed through a factory or an individual or whatever, then was in a whole chain of bartering of stolen goods in order for it to arrive on your table. It's an interesting way to look at it. I don't know that it's completely accurate, but it's one perspective. Any other comments? Thanks for bringing that up, Shane. It's good. These questions usually come up when we talk about killing, because it's said to be, again, the most powerful of all of these. But the one thing to keep in mind, I went through very briefly the process for purification yesterday. All negativities can be purified. The Buddha said there is no negativity at all that we commit that cannot be purified. But we have to have some force behind it, and that's why the four opponent powers are talked about. And I'm not going to teach on those again extensively as part of this, but I'm sure the center here, you have frequent teachings on doing that. But yeah, Tim. Sorry, got another microphone. Thanks, Susie.
I don't know about Santa Fe, but in this area, We actually do have deer sacrifice themselves to us all the time on the highway.
Yeah. It happens
and
there too.
I'm wondering, it wasn't intentional by us, of course.
Sure, sure.
But would it be better to find something that could use that meat? Like in Alaska, if a moose gets hit, they take the meat to a homeless shelter.
Right.
But even though they're eating meat, I mean, would it be worse for it to go to waste or to feed some other being?
Again, I think in an act like that, because your motivation is the compassion for people who lack food in their lives and would happily eat that food, then you are making that offering to them, and the animal is deceased at that point. The consciousness will have left, and so you're really not looking at a major harm to that being at that stage of the game. Yes, if you look at that perspective I mentioned just a few minutes ago about you being involved in stolen goods because the animal didn't offer its body, well, you might have a little bit of that karma, but your intention is good. It's not like you're wanting to cut it up and sell it to people and make money off of it, right? If you're wanting to offer it to somebody, just say, unfortunately this happened, but there's this deer carcass that could, benefit you in terms of the meat that's on that animal. So I don't know. I think that would be, once more, it comes down to our motivation more than it comes down to the act itself. Yeah, thanks for that question, Tim. Yeah, Denise, you've got one.
In that case, it almost seems like anyone who ever dies and has possessions, they're not necessarily offering their possessions, but anybody who disperses any of the possessions of anyone who's died, it would be similarly in a chain of non-offered goods by that argument.
Well, but humans can usually make a conscious choice about what happens to their physical belongings when they leave.
We can, but we don't often.
We don't often. But there are even in our society things that govern that. So, I mean, if you came in to somebody's house that had died and you said, well, they're dead and I can just take whatever I want off the shelf, that's very different than if somebody, you know, who was their children or their whoever would be next in line legally.
I think that
again we have rules in society to govern some of that because we recognize even in our moralistic sense of the world that we wouldn't be good to just leave things haphazardly to disappear after someone dies. So I don't know that it's quite the same situation, maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know. But
that's an interesting way to think about it. Thank you.
Yeah,
I hadn't thought about it that way before.
Yeah. I mean, this is where I personally would just love for at the end of my life to just be thrown in a hole in the ground and let the worms eat me or something. Because, I mean, at that point, it's not even me. It's just this decomposing stuff. You know, why not put it to good use rather than what a lot of people go through in terms of funerals and all of this other stuff, even cremation, you know, which takes a lot of fuel and energy to... It was somebody actually that, I can't remember where I saw this, somewhere on the internet, I think there's these huge containers that they're going to market at some point that a body can be put in that will be the basis for a tree. And so you can actually have yourself become a tree at some point because the roots or seeds of the tree are there in part of this burlap bag that you're in. And you'll just be planted in the ground and the tree will come up out of your body. And that sounds great. Sign me up. What was that?
Anatomy lab.
Great. Thanks, Naga. Any questions more on killing? This is always the one that brings up the most questions, I think. All right, let's go on to the next one. Acting to possess property that has not been offered. This is what I mentioned earlier, the act of stealing. Now, property that has not been offered, I think, you know, we have to acknowledge that a lot of what we might take might be pretty insignificant and probably is not such a big deal. They don't even necessarily say that that would be stealing. Like if you were at somebody's house and you needed to write down a phone number and you took a Post-it off their little pad and wrote on it, you know, without asking, oh, could I have a Post-it? You just grabbed one and wrote down. It's nice to ask, but, you know, a Post-it isn't going to probably be substantial enough to be an act of stealing. Generally, what they say is that it has to be something of value. Now, that becomes very subjective, right? Because what's of value to one person who doesn't have much might not be of value to another person who has a lot. So I think we just have to be very measured in how we go about trying to avoid that and make sure that we ask permission for anything that we take. Can I have a Kleenex? Can I have whatever? I mean, don't take it for granted that everything's just yours to grab and possess and use. You know, actually ask for what it is that... Now, if things are put out in a common area, like out here, there's the shelf with the free books, and it says free books, you know, complimentary, whatever. Well, those are free books, then. You can help yourself to things that are displayed as something that can be taken for free. But when it comes to anything else, we should always be sure that there's some sort of payment for what we take, that we're respecting other people's ownership of those things, and asking before we actually take something. Yes, Susie.
When I came here, I was surprised by the concept of stealing someone's time.
Mm. I mean, in some regard, I don't know that I call it stealing as much as that's a bit of that meaningless talk and what have you, where we're pulling somebody into a situation and generally engaging them in lots of frivolous stuff that is not going to be useful to them in the end. But I suppose we could say, I mean, do you have
an
example?
Well, there's also, for instance, if you say, go over there and get me the, you know, they may do it.
Right.
They may not even think about it, but you're not thinking about their...
Their time and their
time and
what they could use it for. Yeah, no, there is that aspect to it, that you could say you're stealing someone's time. And as they say, Time is money, so time is something that's valuable. I'm not saying that that's exactly what we mean by this, but I'm saying that time is something that's useful, something that we can use for other purposes.
They may have been wanting to go talk to someone
sure.
that would have done
sure.
something. It was a eye-opener for me.
Yeah. I mean, I think they bring this up frequently in regard to members of the Sangha, you know, the ordained community, that we don't want to do things that cause them to do activities that's not what they're there for. I mean, people who actually make that conscious decision to take robes and to live an ordained life, it's for spiritual purposes. It's not some worldly thing. So if we cause them to be engaged in all kinds of activities that are wasting their time, stealing their time, that would definitely be involved in this. I think it's always good to ask people if we have a desire for somebody to do something for us. You know, do you have the time to do this for me? Or if you're not, I'm fine. I'll do it myself, find somebody else, whatever. Any other questions on stealing? Again, the third one is also an area where I frequently get a lot of questions, acting with unwise sexual behavior. We usually use the term sexual misconduct. This is the third of these three that are part of the 10 non-virtues. And in this tradition, we really try to some degree, pinpoint the ones that are the most destructive here. And, of course, the most destructive are when we are engaging in sexual activity that's outside of a committed relationship or that causes disharmony potentially within a committed relationship, or that is non-consensual. You know, certainly rape would be included in this. They don't talk about that so much in the traditional text, but obviously that type of sexual behavior that is non-consensual on the part of the other party would be something that would fall into this category. But usually they identify adultery as the main culprit here. But adultery in our classic sense is somebody having sex outside of a married relationship. And I don't think it has to be that level of relationship. If you have committed yourself to another person in whatever way, whether you're married or not, and that is the understanding that you are with that person exclusively, if you have sex with someone else, then you are committing adultery according to this definition. And then, of course, if you are single and you have sexual relations with someone who is in a committed relationship and you know that they're in a committed relationship, a lot of people lie about whether they're in a committed relationship. So if you don't have that knowledge, and even if you've asked and they say no, they aren't, and they've lied to you, well, then you're working with the best knowledge that you have, right? So you're not complicit in that because you weren't engaged in that activity knowingly. So unwise sexual behavior is usually targeted as that. But I do want to share a little bit from what Henipola Gunaratana says in his book, which I think is really useful because, you know, how we are sexually in the world, for some of us may not be as large a part of our lives as others, but it certainly is a place where, you know, we can have potentially a lot of problems in our lives. And so we need to be attentive to it to a large degree. So let me see if I can pull up the quote that I had for this. Got all these bookmarked, but then I have to find them still through my little process of... Okay. Skillful thinking, skillful action. All right. So, again, he says, these definitions aside, meaning what we just looked at in terms of what we would normally call unwise sexual behavior, people get into a lot of trouble because of their sexual desires. The irony is that lust can never be completely satisfied. No matter how many risks people take or how much pain and suffering people go through to try to fulfill their desires, the wish to fulfill desires does not go away. Some people turn to meditation out of the pain and suffering caused by their sexual desires. Unfortunately, all too often, even during their efforts to gain some concentration and peace of mind, lust keeps bothering them. The only solution to this problem is to begin with disciplining your sexual activity. If you are incapable of a bit of self-discipline, the path to happiness will forever remain elusive. Some very sincere meditators have made great strides in cleaning up bad habits, such as drinking or lying, yet fail to see why they should rein in their sexual behavior. They say, I don't see what's wrong with having a little fun. The traditional list of inappropriate partners and so on, you know, seems to provide a loophole for them. They notice right away that nothing is said against having relations with many partners, so long as they are appropriate and unmarried, or against seeking cheap thrills. But cheap thrills cheapen you and degrade your self-worth. Casual sex hurts you and can injure others. What is the point of this kind of fun? To give you pleasure? To fulfill your desires? Yet we've been saying all along that craving, desire, is the very root of our misery. The Buddha's second truth tells us that all suffering stems from desire. Confused sexual behavior is one of the easiest ways to trap the mind into a cycle of craving and aversion. Sexual pleasures are so alluring, and their downsides, rejection, embarrassment, frustration, jealousy, insecurity, remorse, loneliness, and craving for more, are so unbearable that they keep people running on an endless treadmill. You know, so again, I like his perspective just as another way of looking at this to say, I think once more, just like with any of these other things that we're going through that are involved in our morality, each of us might need to simply take a look at our own lives and say, is there something here that has become problematic for me with regard to my that aspect of my life, my sexual behavior? And then making decisions on the basis of acknowledging that the fundamental drive behind any sexual activity, well, most sexual activity, is desire, right? I mean, that's admittedly part of the game. So the Buddha didn't come to help us, you know, experience our desire. He came to help us overcome our desire. Nonetheless, we can have that as a part of our lives, but to see, making sure that it doesn't go out of control, that we aren't falling prey to that desire all the time. And so I don't know if I need to say a lot more. I don't know most of you in the room as to your lives and what have you, but I would encourage you just to take a look at this idea and see if there's things that you need to address in your life, and then to begin to move in that direction gradually. I don't know. I think in our culture, certainly, this isn't meant to be like, oh, let's go back to before the sexual revolution or something and have all this puritanism around sexuality. I don't think that's the point either. It's rather to just be wise in how we approach all of this. You know, just to have, again, some wisdom we apply as we have that aspect of our lives, which most of us who are not ordained have that aspect to our lives to some degree or another. So just to admit that that is part of it, but that we don't want to get kind of lost in it. Comments on that? Questions about it? Yeah. Don't tell me I know your name. I just can't think of it at the moment. Peter. Okay, thank you, Joanna. I knew there were two Peters here, I think, earlier, like Friday night or something.
There was one down there. And yeah.
Okay, anyway.
So can you briefly talk about why the ordained, you know, when people are
sure.
ordained, why they do it? Because I vaguely understand that, you know, having that as part of your life, I don't want to paint it as being negative, but there are benefits to if you don't have that in your life.
Sure.
So.
And I think that's the major thing, is that the recognition is that if you want to take on robes and live a life that is maybe not 100%, but as close to 100% as you can about the spiritual life, that having the distractions of what they call the householder life, the lay life, it's good to be free of those to whatever degree that they can. Now, in the West, certainly all ordained folks do take a vow of no sexual activity at all. So their way of looking at this precept or this idea is to say, no, shut the door. I'm not going to have sexual activity with anyone. And there's usefulness to that because, once more, you don't have any of those complications, entanglements, potential conflicts, and what have you, and you can keep it really quite contained. But a lot of people who are ordained might still be working corporate jobs or might still be doing other things. There are many people in the West that, unfortunately, because of the culture we have, that doesn't support ordained people to the degree that they should be supported, as in the way that they are supported in Asian cultures, for example. They might still need to do things that are part of the householder life. But this is definitely one way that the Buddha saw to diminish that component of what most of us have as lay people in our lives, to shut that door so that they would have greater energy, time, etc., for spiritual pursuits. Now, when you get to other perspectives, they actually say, I've talked to some people who are ordained, and they do say that there is an energetic thing that happens when that whole avenue is shut off, and there's a change in the enthusiasm that they have for their practice and so on when they aren't distracted in the way that people can be by sexual activity. So I think there's other sort of side effects that come from that that are in line with all of that, but are kind of unique to shutting that particular door.
Can you elaborate?
Can I elaborate? I mean, the
point. I mean, don't to get single pointed concentration.
Yeah.
Don't you have to put that to bed?
Well,
no pun intended.
I think it is very good, Peter. I think to some degree it would be very hard because the whole point of doing this process of gaining single pointed concentration is to keep working with. This trajectory that gets you deeper and deeper in terms of the less distraction going on in the mind and that single-pointed focus that arises from that. And so if you have sexual urges that are distracting you and you keep going back to them, maybe you spend some time kind of going a particular direction and then you go back to that level of distraction, it's going to be very hard for the mind to completely settle. And I don't think it's just sexual urges. I think it also has to do with, because when we get to some of these prerequisites for developing single-pointed concentration, this is what's taught in the Lam Rim around developing calm abiding, is that you need to have a mind that has relatively few wants and desires. You really want to shut off a lot of that isn't just sexual activity. It's also wanting delicious food and wanting, you know, entertaining things in our lives, wanting to stream movies at night or whatever the case might be. How could you get the mind to fully settle down and become single-pointed if it's constantly going out to those things, and then you have to get it to settle again, and then it goes out to those things, and you have to get it to settle again? We face this problem in our world at large, is that it's very hard for our meditation practice to go extremely deep when we're living a life that's engaged with a lot of different activities and distractions. If you really want to be serious about attaining these levels of concentration, the best way is to shut yourself off from all of that in a retreat environment where you don't have them. Now, the mind might still be going to them. That's the work you still have to do, but at least they won't be there for you to be entertained by and distracted by. So, I mean, the one example in particular, there was a nun I talked to once who we weren't talking about sex or anything. We were just talking about in general what it was like being ordained, and she just said that she just found that cutting that off for her really increased just her own personal energy and things. She just felt like there was an opening to another door. So I think we have the tendency of thinking that if we shut that off, that we're without it. We're going to feel this kind of gaping hole of needing something. And for her, it was the exact opposite experience. Cutting that off kind of opened up an avenue for a different way of being and a different expression of her being without that particular aspect of her life. I don't know. I mean, I think different people have different experiences with it. I'm sure there are monastics who struggle with this idea of maintaining that particular vow. But anyway, if you do take the vow in Buddhism, in this particular tradition, to avoid sexual misconduct, it is really avoiding adultery, you know, that type of behavior. It's not, you know, anything kind of beyond that. You know, it's not taking a vow not to have any sexual activity at all. That would only be entailed if you take ordination. So you can make that decision if you'd like to try it. Some people live in, you know, chastity, don't engage in any type of sexual activity. And actually, I do think that there's some great benefits to doing that. Don't ask me whether I'm doing that. You won't get an answer. Anyone else? Thanks for your question, Peter. So again, I'm sorry for me to gauge everyone's thinking around this based on just talking about it, but it's, you know, don't take it all like too seriously. Once more, even with the killing thing, as I was mentioning to Shane, you know, you have to each of us look at our own lives and decide, well, what does this mean for me? Knowing that this is entailed in some behavior that is not going to be so beneficial for me. Because once more, recall that going back to our little diagram here, that these three that we call the wheel or the training of morality that are part of this wheel are there to support our concentration. They're meant to be the foundation for practicing good concentration. So it's not just sexual activity, it's also the extent to which we steal, to which we are killing, to which we are lying, you know, and all of these that are affecting our meditative states and the quality of our mind and meditation. Let's go on then to the last one, which is actually added by Henapola Gunaratana in his text, and I really like including it there, is acting that abuses our senses or diminishes our judgment. You know, in the traditional lay precepts, that sexual misconduct is one of the lay precepts to avoid. The fifth one is not having alcohol and intoxicants, right? Some of you in the room may have taken that vow. People in the West have a real hard time taking that vow, and that may be for a variety of reasons. Alcohol and intoxicants are a part of our culture, and even are some part of our social culture. It can be very hard to not have those. I mean, I think my mom's finally stopped doing it. I would like go to visit her, and she knows that I don't drink, that I've got that vow not to drink alcohol. And she'd be like, oh, that you don't drink, but would you still like to taste my wine? You know, and it's like, well, no, that's drinking alcohol. I mean, so I think in our culture, it's very hard to hold that one. But this is a part of this last point, is acting that abuses our senses or diminishes our judgment. So it means overindulging in things. And it may not be just alcohol and intoxicants. It can be food. It can be television. It can be binge watching on Netflix. It can be anything that kind of, or even reading. A lot of people just spend hours and hours, like, you know, reading lots of novels and juicy things, and don't really, again, that's a bit of that wasting of time, but it's moreover, it does diminish the acuity of your mind to some degree, because you're spending so much time engaged in more mundane types of activities and affairs. I'm not saying, again, that every one of us is going to have 24/7 spiritual lives. That's not what I think most of us can accomplish. But we just have to recognize patterns that we are engaged in that tend to do that, that just dull in everything, that we just become a bit stupefied by everything that we're engaged in. I don't know if anyone else wants to talk to that. Yeah, Peter. Sorry, Susie.
Is that the same as the vow of not abusing my own aggregates?
That vow is taught as part of, I think, the tantric vows, isn't it? Maybe I shouldn't talk about that so much. I'm not sure that it's exactly the same. I think some of the behaviors are involved in that. Yeah. You know, aggregates, by the way, for those of you who don't know this word, this is a way of referring to the physical and mental components of our being, our mind and body, and they're divided further than that. Mind is, but anyway, we can say mental and physical components of our being. So abusing our minds or abusing our bodies. But I think there's even more to that vow than that, and I can't really go into that. But in essence, yes, any of these types of behaviors would be a part of that. I was going to read something from, again, this is Henapola Gunaratana. It says, what areas of your behavior have you left unexamined? Areas in which you push your mind or body beyond a reasonable point just for pleasure or escape? Ask yourself, am I indulging in hours of watching television or doing non-essential paperwork late into the night, eating more than what is necessary to sustain my life, going to clubs where the music is so loud that my ears ring when I leave, using my body for pleasure in ways that make it tired, sore, and unfit for work the next day? Do I make use of the internet in ways that benefit my life and my community, or am I simply entertaining myself until my eyes are bleary and my mind is numb? You know, so, you know, I think, again, each of us might have to look at that, and maybe we don't go to that extreme. Maybe we don't get, like, completely, you know, zonked out by these activities, but we have to look at our lives and see how are we structuring our lives and how much of that is really necessary. And if we do, and admittedly, a part of maintaining our enthusiasm for our practice is being able to have some downtime, have some time where we replenish our energy and what have you. But if what we're engaging in tends to dull in the mind and make the body even more exhausted, it's probably not such a good idea. The other thing is to bring a good motivation to why we're doing that. So if you sit down and you've had a full day engaging in teachings, like people who have been coming here, and you go home at night and you want to sit down and turn on the TV and watch a movie and just let the mind chill, we'll do that, but with the motivation to sit down and say, I'm doing this knowing that I want to be at my best in terms of my spiritual practice. I really want to use this time well, so I'm going to have some positive thoughts around it. This is all part of my practice. And you can do that. Again, as I mentioned yesterday, you can have bodhicitta mindfulness for anything. Remember Venerable Rabina, when she was in Santa Fe once, we did a weekend of teachings with her, and I was like so exhausted by the end of the teachings. And on that Sunday afternoon, she was talking about effort, joyous effort, which is one of the six perfections that Denise brought up on Friday night. We're going to get to effort. There's a correct effort here as well. Anyway, one of these powers that we apply in our effort, and it's even on your sheet, is the power of relinquishment or letting go of our work, which is an important part of replenishing our energy and resources, is to say, okay, I'm setting all that aside for the moment because I need to recharge. I need to take care of myself so I can continue to do the work. And I mentioned to her how it's a bit of a slippery slope, though, sometimes, because you become quite seduced by a lot of those sorts of things. And I told her, I said, and this is when Downton Abbey was on TV. I really liked Downton Abbey. And I said, well, Venerable Bina, like, all I'm thinking about is, like, I want to go home after this retreat and just turn on Downton Abbey and watch the new episode or whatever. And she says, well, Don, if you're going to do it with bodhicitta, or don't do it at all. You know, and she was, like, really adamant with me. And I was like, oh, yes, of course I will. You know, so we can bring thoughts to our activities, and it does affect the flavor of those activities. That's the whole point of Rinpoche's teachings in the book that I mentioned that's free out in the hallway, The Bodhisattva Attitude, the teachings on bodhicitta mindfulness. You know, you can go to the bathroom with bodhicitta. You can turn on a light with bodhicitta. You can do all these activities with bodhicitta, and it changes the action because it's your mind doing involved in that. So you sit down with your popcorn. I like popcorn, too. Sit down with your popcorn, turn on the TV or whatever, and generate your bodhicitta motivation. Think that you're going to watch a movie for the sake of all sentient beings, to relieve their suffering, to lead them to happiness. Change the whole movie experience, right? Anyway, might sound simplistic, but this is how we actually make progress on our path, is by thinking about bodhicitta all the time. It becomes, you know, our default motivation for everything that we do. Any other questions on these four, then? For 4 points, again, that included an extra one in terms of anything that is a way that we use our bodies that may not be so beneficial to scope. I could say even some people maybe over-exercise, right, and get totally obsessed with needing to do so much that is, I mean, I heard about one man who wrote a book, actually, about how he did 30 of these, I think it was 30 of these Ironman competitions or something. But he did them in a row, I think, or something like that. Maybe it was 10 in a row. I don't know what it was. It was like quite a large number in a row. I mean, and at one point he was like hobbling through with a broken leg, you know, and he's just like, oh my gosh, you know, what is this poor man doing to himself? I can't speak for his mind, and maybe he's a bodhisattva or a Buddha for all I know, but it just sounds to me like potentially a little extreme. Potentially. Let's look on the other page then, page 3 at the top, and then we'll take a short break. Skillful physical actions, we want to adopt those actions of body that protect and help others and enhance our own well-being. So we act to protect life. So there is a difference between some of these, by the way, it's important to point out, there's a difference between not killing and protecting life, right? All of you in the room are not killing right now, but you're probably not actively protecting life. I mean, maybe you have thoughts of protecting life, but you know, there's a difference between saying, oh, there's an ant in the water, I'm not going to kill it, and then walking away, versus there's an ant in the water, I'm not going to kill it, oh, and I'm going to put a leaf in to get it out of the water so it doesn't drown, right? It's a very simple example, but we have to go further sometimes in our behavior, I think, and not just say, oh, I'm not going to do these things, but I'm going to do something that is the polar opposite, which is all my actions be about protecting the lives of others, protecting the truth, upholding the truth, all these other things we've already looked at. So the next one, acting to value and respect others' possessions, doing what we can to help protect others' possessions when we're in that position to do that, or to certainly value them. If you borrow the next door neighbor's, you know, weed whacker, well, then make sure you value it and take care of it so that when you give it back to them, it's in good shape and whatever. I mean, these kind of, they sound kind of simple, but they're a way of kind of making sure that we are in harmony with others around us because our physical actions respect them. Acting wisely and lovingly with one's sexuality, if one is in a committed relationship where there's genuine love and concern for the other, and the sexual behavior is within that context and not extreme or excessive, then by all means, I think it's a wonderful expression of our love and our connection to others, and can be very much reinforcing positive attitudes on the part of both people involved. You know, we don't need to go to these extremes again of thinking we have to shut off that avenue of our lives. Some of us might be inclined to do that at one point or another in our lives. That's a personal choice. But if we are engaged in behavior with others, make it loving, make it wise. Then, of course, acting with moderation and discernment toward sense objects, making sure that we have that understanding of where we've gone too far and trying to control that to make sure that we don't get lost in those experiences. And then this is the one that I added here in terms of Rinpoche's suggestion, acting with deeper motivation even in mundane acts, bodhicitta motivation and bodhicitta mindfulness. Any questions on those? I think they're pretty evident, but everyone wants a break. Okay, take a break. So it's about 2:51 according to this watch, maybe a little bit later than that, but we'll try to go just till a little after 3, like 1 or 2 minutes after 3. Hopefully that gives enough time for everybody. Just as a way of recapping then this right action, the fourth of these 8 steps, we could use the same sort of questions that we had for right speech that Eric Kolvig came up with, right? For right speech, it was, what am I saying and why am I saying it? For right action, we could say, what am I doing and why am I doing it? You know, to be real clear that we want to be as beneficial with our actions as possible. And we are embodied beings. We do relate at times with people in that context. And it's good to always have that kind of motivation that's clear behind those actions. Let's go on to step 5, right livelihood. Now, I will be doing a talk on Wednesday night that will be about work as a spiritual path. And I'll talk a little bit about some of this there. But the things that I brought up here are really quite nice. This is where I thought actually that Henipola Gunaratana's book is really quite useful, because in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, we don't talk about right livelihood so much. It's kind of interesting. You know, this isn't something that's discussed so much. And even, I think, one teacher, Alex Berzin, on his website, he was talking about how most of his Tibetan teachers simply saying, you know, that you shouldn't be engaged in a livelihood where there's harm to others. And that was about all the extent of it. And I think that to some degree that's a good place to start, but I think we have to examine things a little more closely again, and each of us may have different aspects in our jobs that we might need to be a bit more attentive to. So let's look at what I've got here as a description on page 3 for step 5. Having correct or skillful livelihood entails engaging in a means of making a living that does not interfere with our spiritual developments. This is maybe a slightly different way of looking at it, is to say, does my work, my occupation, what I do for a living, interfere with my spiritual development? You know, ideally, we want it to support our spiritual development. This is a bit of what we're going to look at on Wednesday night, is, I think, something that could be pretty universally applied to anyone's job, that could be a ways of making what happens over the course of a day in our work into a spiritual path. But in essence, we want to make sure that it doesn't interfere with our spiritual development. So it's as it says here, this third element in our practice of morality is also informed by right understanding and intention, meaning that, again, we want to keep those ideas in mind as we examine this topic for ourselves. So for this one, we don't have kind of, I mean, there is a looking at what is unskillful activity or unskillful livelihood. But it's put in the positive here of what is skillful livelihood. If possible, we want our means of living to benefit others or to at least avoid acquiring resources, which is our food, clothing, any livelihood, in any way that involves, first, illegal activities. You know, so if we do have to break the law to, I mean, if you're a drug dealer that is, you know, dealing in illegal substances, that this would obviously be not such a useful way to get one's livelihood. But there are many illegal activities beyond just drug dealing, and probably have to, again, each of you take a look at your own occupation and see to what degree any of these are factors. Because it might not be the entirety of your job, but it might be a portion of your job. maybe. Trading weapons gets into, again, the third one there, you know. I mean, we might find that, yeah, if they're illegal, if we're, like, doing that without people getting the proper paperwork for them and, you know, breaking the law by giving them to others, selling them to others, then probably we are running into that. But you may even have some occupations where, say, you work for a company in their financial area and part of your job is to hide from the government certain things that your company does. Well, the company isn't engaged in illegal activities, but you're trying to use some form of deceit in regard to avoiding things, and this is illegal. I mean, we would definitely want to be careful in those sorts of things. The second one, any livelihood involving coercion, violence, trickery, or deceit, and that includes any of what we traditionally call the five wrong livelihoods, and these are more of in a Tibetan Buddhist presentation. You'll frequently hear these talked about. Those of you who studied the Lam Rim, this is in the section where we talk about not offering things to the three jewels, not putting offerings on our altar that were acquired through any of these five wrong livelihoods. So what are those five wrong livelihoods? I mean, first we have, you know, coercion is kind of covered in there. It's kind of coercing somebody, extorting money from somebody, blackmailing, anything that kind of involves using force to acquire resources. So it's, again, violence, I think, is quite clear. Trickery, deceit, those are kind of included in, to some degree, what we just talked about, extortion, but also, to some degree, hypocrisy. I'm going, kind of jumping around a little here, sorry. But hypocrisy is where we kind of deceive others into thinking that we're worthy of resources that we aren't. And we can do this, again, in a variety of ways, but it's just putting out, you know, the idea that we're better than we really are. So if you, in an interview, for example, if you say you have all kinds of experience and skills and abilities that you lack, that's a form of hypocrisy, you know, and that's a form of tricking others into hiring you, deceiving others into thinking you're the best person for the job when you actually have that, don't have that experience. So even when we get a job on the basis of this sort of thing, we are flavoring, you know, our livelihood by virtue of having done that. Going back to some of them that are in this category of the five wrong livelihoods, the first one is flattery. Sometimes we get things from others, maybe not our paycheck necessarily, but we might acquire things by telling other people all kinds of nice things about them, right? You know, oh, you're such a generous person, you're so kind. Well, you know, if we say that to that person often enough, they might start being kind and generous to us. So if we're using flattery as a technique to obtain resources, not so good. Hinting is kind of this idea of like saying, oh, you have such lovely things in your house. Those would look so good in my house or something, you know, maybe that's more direct even, but it's like giving some idea that you're trying to plant in that person's head that might ripen into them giving you something. Oh, this is such a lot. I mean, say you collect like little bird statues or something and you're at somebody and you go, oh, this is such a pretty bird statue. It would look so nice in my collection. You know, you're not asking for it. And by the way, asking for something isn't wrong livelihood. If you actually say, I really need some money right now and can you possibly help me with that? I mean, that's coming right out. Being direct, if you really need money, well then by all means, ask for it. Or if you really want that statue of that bird or whatever the case might be. But when we deceive others to get these, or when we do these kinds of tricky techniques of, oh, if you say something nice enough about it, well then the person will eventually say, oh, you really like that. Would you like it? Can I give it to you? You're kind of playing on their vulnerability and inducing them to be generous and give you whatever, any type of possession really for that matter. We already talked about, well, extortion, blackmail, hypocrisy, bribing. Sometimes bribing they even refer to as giving something small with the hopes that you'll get something larger. And that's a bit what bribing is, right? You know, and when it comes down to it, if somebody is bribing in the government world, they give a little bit of money to somebody with the hopes that they'll get the big government contract. Well, it's illegal, so it is an illegal activity in many parts of society. But doing this with others, just to, you know, give them something small. We do fall into this potentially if we're in any way sponsored by people. Some people in the ordained community are sponsored by benefactors who support them in terms of their spiritual practice. And so for some people who are in those types of positions, these can be really quite easy to fall into. You might think, oh, I'd never do that. But there are situations where you might do these things. So any way that we are about getting something from others through deceiving them, tricking them, bribing them, what have you. Does that make sense? Any questions on that one? Yes, Susan. Okay.
What do you think about the stock market?
Yeah, I was talking over the break even about, you know, when we're in the real estate market, if we're buying a house and trying to bring somebody down in price and, you know, anything that involves these sorts of fluctuations and prices and what have you, and people earning money, people losing money, sometimes us taking money away from others, that, yeah, they're tricky things. I think once more we have to have real clear motivation and intention as to why we're doing what we're doing. I think so much of Wall Street and all of the economic industry has a large motivation of greed that is undeniable to some degree, and I'm not trying to put anybody down who's in that occupation, but rather recognize that that's part of the environment, is that it's fed on greed and on wanting more and accumulating more and having, you know, new things down the pike all the time that are going to increase one's wealth and resources for oneself as well as the company that one works for. So I think we just have to be real, real clear about why we're in such an occupation, and if we feel genuine about being there, and that we, I mean, if someone's like helping someone to invest in the stock market, for example, they're on that side of it where they have clients that they're working with, and some of them can be just ordinary folks like us in the room who might want to make a little money off of our money or whatever the case might be. If you have that genuine concern for the welfare of others, you want them to get into a good market that they can benefit from and make some money from. I don't know that it's so bad, but if you yourself are driven by a greedy mind that just simply wants that next client to be able to make the commission, to be able to do this, to be able, and it's all about yourself and you don't really care what the person invests in, and maybe you even direct them into things that'll give you a greater commission because you want a greater commission and it's not a good investment for that person. So it becomes complicated when it gets down to the brass tacks. But, you know, in general, this is the world we live in. There is a financial market and there is some benefit from that and there is some detriment to it. So I don't think it's by nature an occupation we have to avoid, but I think we just have to be careful that you don't get kind of sucked up into the mentality that can be there, or at least it's demonstrated in some circles and maybe in movies a lot, you know, when they show people who are in that business, that line of work. I don't know, do you have feelings about it, Susan, from your experience?
Well, I do, and I wasn't thinking about it so much from the occupation point of view.
Oh, from the individual investing.
Right. I mean, yeah. Although my occupation is in that vein, but, I don't have any struggles with that.
Right.
It is just, like, investing these days seems like just a way to make money off of something that just might go up. And sure. I struggle with that.
I mean, I can't speak for everyone in regard to this whole issue. I think it becomes an individual choice for people as to how they want to go about doing that. I mean, I think it's wise if you're going to be involved in this to once more recognize that some of, if your livelihood and resources that you gain from that are from businesses that are not so wholesome in what they're doing, then in a sense, you're a bit complicit with that if you're knowingly doing that. But once more, I mean, we should know where our money is and where it's being invested. But I think it's very tricky. Because I would say probably even a lot of Buddhist organizations, perhaps the FPMT, might have money invested in markets and what have you that they sustain as a way of bringing in some money. I mean, I even know that, maybe I shouldn't say this, but there's been cases where, maybe I won't say anything. Better for me to be quiet. But I think it brings up things too around like lotteries and stuff like that, even gambling, you know, ways that we maybe acquire resources through something that is not particularly that wholesome. At the same time, a lot of lotteries are about supporting schools and supporting other parts of society, so, you know, maybe it's not quite the same. So I think we have to be careful with all of these ways of making money, but recognize that we're probably not going to be able to get a clean dollar in the end when it comes down to it, absolutely clean, but rather it's a complex world that we live in with a lot of interdependence. So I don't know. I don't know if that helped or not. I kind of skirted the issue a bit. Yes, Susie.
If someone's supporting a member of the Sangha,
mm-hmm.
does that member have to think about what that person does to gain money?
That's a good question. So say, yeah, you're supported, you're in the Sangha, you're ordained, and you're supported by somebody who works for a weapons factory or something. If you knowingly are taking money from that, I think that to some degree, you probably would want to say thank you very much, but, you know, might be better for your money to go elsewhere or something. You know, there's a woman, she comes to Santa Fe frequently, named Lynn Twist, and she wrote a book called The Soul of Money or something like that. And she tells a story about how she was involved in some project and somebody came in who was a big donor, and she knew the background of that person and knew that the money just didn't have the right feel to it, and she denied it. And what was interesting is she had some karma ripen that caused equal or more money to come in from another avenue that was more beneficial. And so I think we have to be careful about taking in resources that we know are acquired in means that are maybe not so beneficial, but I don't know. I mean, again, these get to be complex issues because there's not that many degrees of separation between us and whatever other money, you know. My father, many of us had parents, maybe even many of us in the room might have been in the military. And the military in and of itself, you might think, well, it's not by nature a faulty career, but at the same time, there is that aspect to it that it's about war. It's a war machine. It's the military there to, you know, defend the country and what have you. I don't know. So my father was in the Army, and I benefited from his paycheck every week, you know, helping to raise me and what have you. But I don't know that makes me completely complicit in everything that the Army does. But, yeah, anyway. Yeah.
And now we benefit from your knowledge.
By virtue of that.
So yeah. It might have.
I don't know. Yeah. I mean, even while I was in the master's program, I invested money that I had from my job at Levi Strauss and benefited from that money that I invested to be able to continue studying over there for the 7 years that I was there. So I don't know. I mean, it gets to be, there's a lot of gray area, I think, when it comes to investments and things. Yeah, Chris.
I'm curious about why illegal activities are mentioned there, because there's not a high correlation between what's legal and what's ethical, and sometimes they contradict each other.
Sure,
so,
sure.
For example, if I worked for the Underground Railroad and helped people escape from slavery,
right,
that would violate the Fugitive Slave Act and be illegal.
Right.
So would you say that that would be a wrong livelihood?
Yeah, I think there's probably some exceptions, as you're pointing out, where we could say that, I don't know that there's a clear line in that regard. I would say that why it's on the list is probably because the tendency is for most of what is illegal, not all, but most of what is illegal, to perhaps be unethical, to turn towards the unethical.
Then why not just say don't do unethical things? Because if it's wrong to do something illegal when it's unethical and not when it's not, then you're really talking about ethics, not legality.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I mean, I was going to go back to, because this is another point that I got from the Eightfold Path book. So let me just see if I can find where that is actually set out. No, I agree with you completely, because I think that there are definitely those points where we will see some differences between what is illegal and what is ethical. I mean, in some countries, they have bribery as part of doing business, and it's totally accepted as a legal activity, not an illegal one. You know, that may have even come from the other book. I'm not going to find the answer by scrolling through my Kindle, but
So it's not from a like a directly
I don't think it's,
from a Buddhist source.
I don't think the Buddhist said that. Yeah. I mean, you know, I don't think that it goes back to saying that the Buddha said don't do anything that's illegal in your country. I think that generally a lot of what's illegal is unethical, and as you said, then perhaps it should be phrased as what is unethical. But I think ethics even vary once more from culture to culture and country to country. So we have to look at when we're living within a particular country. I think this is one example that sometimes used here is within the United States, for example, it is illegal not to pay taxes, right? I mean, they can come after you legally for not paying taxes. There's laws about that. Well, some people may have ideas that paying taxes isn't such a good thing because of what our taxes might be used for and so on. But nonetheless, I've heard from many Tibetan lamas that it's not good karma to not pay your taxes.
That contradicts another one of their teachings, though. at least if you're the tax collector.
Yeah, these are hard to get completely clear. So, again, we just have to each do our own investigation. I even got into a little bit of a discussion with one student, maybe a bit of a heated discussion, because he was making points about not paying taxes because of what taxes are used for. And I was like, well, but you live in a country where taxes are required, and taxes aren't exclusively used for military and other things that you might not support. They're used also to produce roads that people can drive on to get where they go and so on. So you can think, and I, again, because thoughts are so central to all of this, that the taxes that you pay are being used for those resources. And there are people in this country who unfortunately think that the taxes they pay are used to produce weapons and defend the country. So we can also have another thought, that is the thought that the money we give to the government is used for beneficial purposes. So
not much of it's given.
Yeah.
Most of it is an example of taking what's not freely offered, which also...
Well, but we're going to get into an area here where it's going to become a little harder to get through the weeds and what have you. So it's probably best just to let it go, because it's a complex issue. Because we do all benefit from some of the tax money that's used in this country to some degree. It's complex. Anyway. Any other comments? Thanks, Chris, for bringing that up, though. I think, again, we would have to maybe use a bit more discernment as to what's on the list as an illegal activity, as to whether it's something that we would necessarily need to avoid. If there is a good motivation for why we're doing something, then, yeah, I think it's perfectly fine. The last point that you have on that bullet point under skillful livelihood is where it creates harm and suffering for others, including dealing in weapons, dealing in living beings, including raising animals for slaughter or enslaving or exploiting human beings, poisons, intoxicants. I think it's important that we try to get our livelihood from branches of business or whatever that are not involved in any of those types of things. Certainly there's a lot of controversy in this country about animals being used for medical research and what have you. And I think that this is something that's, again, an area that individuals might need to examine, if that is something that you're involved in, as to whether you want to have that as part of where your livelihood comes from, is inflicting pain and suffering on animals and so on. But again, it's very personal, and each of you would need to do your own investigation there. The investigation, how you actually do that, I added here because I really like this part in particular that was in this book, that, again, the note is there. Actually, that's why it's from the book by Bhikkhu Bodhi. I see my footnote now that I didn't recognize or see earlier. So what I was talking about was from the other book where it says illegal activities. So I might try to look that up before we conclude today. But these are from the 8 Mindful Steps to Happiness, a threefold investigation, 3 questions that are kind of interrelated that one can go through in investigating whether you are engaged in wrong livelihood. First, is your job by nature harmful to yourself or others? Again, that's kind of that idea of are you involved in producing weapons? Are you involved in doing something that causes some, you know, direct harm to beings? Obviously, there's some harm with, you know, just trucks out on the road or whatever the case might be, things that are produced. But is it by nature harmful? Like when I worked for Levi Strauss, I was involved in the garment industry. You know, sure, there's parts of the process, I'm sure, of producing clothes that beings are harmed for, but there's no by nature harm. They weren't setting out to kill beings. They're setting out to make clothes that go on the bodies of human beings. So not really a business by nature that's harmful. But we each have to go through this investigation. Secondly, does my job cause me to break any of the five precepts or other vows and commitments? So do you have to lie every day for work? Do you have to steal? Do you have to kill? I mean, I'm hoping you don't have to engage in sexual misconduct for your work, but I don't know. And, you know, do you have to take intoxicants and alcohol for your work? And sometimes that is required, right? I mean, you need to be out there with the boss and the clients and doing all the entertaining and socializing and what have you. And for some people, that may be an issue. If you don't have that vow and are okay with not feeling like, again, it's abusing your body, your mind by doing that, then there's nothing really wrong with that if your business is perfectly fine. But the third one is where we really have to do, I don't know, some deeper investigation. Are there factors in my job that disturb my mind or make it difficult to settle down? You know? This may be like where we actually go, wow, well, my job's perfectly fine, but to tell you the truth, when I come home every day, I'm just so frazzled and I can't even like think straight and I don't sleep well and whatever the case might be. Well, maybe that's harmful to your spiritual development. Yeah. Again, as I'm going to go through on Wednesday night, I'll talk about how to make any of the aspects of our daily job, daily work, into a spiritual path to some degree. But this may be the place where some people might say, well, maybe I need to find some different employment because it's not really supporting what I want to do with my mind at this moment. I don't have the tools and the wherewithal to be actually able to do that with my job. So this is... I like this because to me it's a really nice format for how each of us can investigate if we need to make a change in our employment. And that shouldn't be the message that you take away from any of this discussion, is that you have to make a change in your employment. You may feel perfectly fine with something that is by nature harmful, you know, to others, and feel like you can still work with that. I mean, there was an example given in that book about a woman who worked for a business. I don't remember all the details, but they were involved in some questionable activities and things. And she felt like leaving the company at that time wouldn't have been as useful as staying and helping them to correct the course, helping them to actually address those behaviors. You know, if everybody runs away from companies that aren't doing anything there, that are doing something that is illegal or not so wholesome, well, then there's no forces within the company for that change to happen. So if you're dedicated to being there so you can actually turn the company in a different direction or even the people that you work with in a slightly different direction. I mean, I'll share a short story from when I worked at Levi Strauss. One of the programs that we got really into for a good number of years was improving our customer service. By customer, we didn't mean necessarily the person buying jeans. We meant the people that we were working with in the stores that sold all of our products and so on. And we really wanted to improve delivery to these folks so that they would get things on a more timely basis, have their orders filled and so on. And we were getting measured on that. And there was a way that the system was measuring our performance so that we could tell whether our customer service was going up or down. And we kept falling short of the goals. And in one meeting, one person at least, I don't remember how many, were wanting to see if we could manipulate the system to be able to get the results that we wanted rather than meeting the goal with the given requirements that we had. And I just like said, wait a second, what are we doing here? I mean, I tried to be some voice of reason against that. I think they did shut up for the moment, but I don't know if there were other meetings where they, you know, talked about that. But once I brought it up, I think they felt a little embarrassed that they were thinking that way. But you know, we do tend to sometimes fall into those patterns. So we might have to speak up and address it if we see it in others, if we see that the results are being skewed because of, you know, a desire to report particular figures or whatever. And so I think that, again, each of us might not need to change our jobs, but maybe we have to change how we are in our jobs, what it is that we do to try to help in different directions. A microphone for Andre. Great. Thanks, Chris.
What about situations in which people are forced to do these kind of jobs that are harmful, harmful, for instance, if you're in military service, mandatory military service,
sure.
Of if you are a victim of human trafficking and you have, you're a prostitute, and because you're being forced to do kind of things. So what happens in those cases?
What happens in terms of
of the consequences for the individual who is being forced to kill or et cetera.
Right. I mean, in terms of, again, if they're being forced into it, they don't really have any choice. And we wouldn't want to necessarily certainly be involved in anything that's doing that, any business that's doing that. But from the point of view of the person who's actually forced to do that, I don't know that the karma would be as strong, because once more, if there's any karma at all, because they are really under the control of another person who is dictating their behavior and are not doing it with their own intention to sell their body for a living or to do that type of work, you know. So I think any of these things where someone is coerced into doing it, the karma wouldn't be there, because we're really talking about, when it comes down to all of this around livelihood, is what type of karma are we creating? What is it that we're engaged in, so that we'll try to keep it as clean and pure as possible, so that we don't have ramifications in terms of where our livelihood is coming from? But for the person who has to feed themselves or through that sort of means where they're coerced into behavior, I don't know that we would have quite the same effect, because there's no choice on their part, right? That's why it's such a horrible situation to be in, is because they're forced into doing this type of behavior and degrading behavior, horrible behavior. But I don't know that they're collecting karmically the same sort of thing that probably the person who's forcing them and coercing them into doing that is collecting the brunt of the karma, right? Because they wouldn't be engaged in it if that person hadn't forced them to do that. I don't know. I haven't been asked that question before, but that's how I would understand it. I don't know that, again, there's a clear teaching that addresses it. But once more, our karma, in terms of our livelihood, in terms of our speech, in terms of our action, primarily comes from our minds. As I pointed out when we went through some of the other actions too, that you could lie, and even what Chris brought up, the example of, you know, going against what are norms and laws within societies, do things that are more beneficial for some people who are marginalized by society. We can actually, you know, engage in those behaviors with good intentions, and they become positive actions. They don't, you know, have always the flavor of negativity. It depends upon our minds. So it would depend upon the mindset of the individuals who are coerced into that behavior. Any other questions on this? I know these are kind of tough issues to tackle, and I apologize that I'm not so skillful in addressing all of them. But so let's go on and just talk briefly. We've got about a little less than a half hour to cover the last three steps, but I want to give you at least some direction on how to work with these yourself. This is really our, again, going back to the summary sheet with the color coding on it. We're about to enter into the blue area. There are three spokes for the blue area, these being right effort, right mindfulness, right meditation or concentration. And these, once more, are all about how we train our minds to have single-pointed concentration, to be able to penetrate more deeply into the teachings, into the training in wisdom, so that we can eventually overcome the patterns of ignorance and so on that are behind all of our suffering. And as I mentioned earlier, you have to have a good foundation of morality. This was even brought up in Peter's question and some of what we talked about earlier, that if you are very dispersed in your thinking and having lots of distractions and lots of stuff going on, it's very hard for the mind to settle down. So we have to have a more concerted focus and effort being put into our meditation and our concentration to free ourselves from those sorts of distractions. And if we've got good morality to begin with, we'll have a much easier time doing that. So good morality is definitely the foundation for developing concentration. So let's look at step 6 on page 3. Having correct or skillful effort entails cultivating the exertion necessary in order to learn and practice the Buddha's teachings and accomplish the entire path to enlightenment. Skillful effort directed toward meditation furthers the training in concentration, this third higher training that we're looking at now. So what we're saying here, in essence, is that we need this kind of skillful effort in regard to a lot of things on our path. You know, if you want to get really proficient in any of the Buddhist practices, practicing patience, generosity, what have you, any of these that are taught, you do have to put some effort into it. But in particular here, we're looking at the effort that is required to help us to develop this single-pointed concentration, this undisturbed mind. So skillful effort says there are four ways that we apply right effort. First is preventing the arising of negative states of mind not yet present, weakening and overcoming negative states of mind that are already present, and then in regard to those that are positive, adopting those that are not yet present, and maintaining and increasing the positive states of mind that are already present. So in essence, we can say once more, this goes back to that whole idea that our effort is about trying to move the mind in a more positive direction and diminish and decrease and eventually eliminate everything that is negative. Sounds rather simplistic again, but it does require effort to do that. No effort involved in just continuing to do what you're doing, right? You know, to continue to have a distracted mind, continue to be caught up in all kinds of things that are not so wholesome and helpful. But again, effort. Effort, when it's made, will help us to actually have that result, to increase the positive states of mind, decrease those that are negative. So that's the general role of effort. When it comes to how effort plays out in meditation, we look at, the first of all, what are called, on, this is on page 4 at the top, the five hindrances. And these are five factors that impede our progress. They cause us to kind of not achieve the results of concentration, single-pointed concentration, and we have to actually make effort to overcome these. So again, sitting in meditation is a job, and this is the one thing we all have come to realize, I'm sure those of you who do meditation. It's not like, you know, oh, I'm just going to sit here and be all relaxed. I mean, you can, and you'll probably just fall asleep. You know, that's not meditation. Meditation, concentration, is about making the mind very sharp and focused. It's a heightened state of being, not a kind of dull, zoning out kind of thing. It's bringing attention to the mind in a very powerful way. We're going to see this when we get into right mindfulness and the last of these eight steps, right concentration or right meditation. These five, I'm just going to go through them briefly again. Excitement is the tendency of the mind to move out to objects that we're quite tantalized by, particularly those things that we've experienced in the past that we want to re-experience. So, you know, it's like the craving for desirable experiences that we know from the past. Regret is working with past experiences as well, but it's usually having a negative feeling about them, not feeling so good about those experiences. So excitement and regret are put together because they're the tendency of the mind to kind of move out, to be distracted out to various things, things that are delicious and delightful that we know from the past, things that are maybe not so wonderful that we've done in the past. And so if you sit in meditation, you can frequently see that these are forces that do cause the mind not to be very settled, that we have to make an effort to curtail. If they start to arise in the mind getting all distracted in that way by having a lot of excitement or even potentially regret, then we have to pull the mind back, bring the mind back down to the meditation object that we're working with. Dullness and sleepiness. These are put together because the dullness of the mind, which is when the mind tends to get just very kind of unfocused, you don't really have a sharpness to the mind. Then sleepiness, which we know, because that's when we actually have the withdrawal of the senses and the mind goes into that sleep state. These two are put together because, again, they're a drawing inward of the mind, whereas the first two were drawing out, in a sense, to things that can distract us. Here it's this drawing in of the mind. And most of us who do meditation, I'm sure, know that some days we might have one of these two, or sometimes we might have the other one, and sometimes we have both. Or maybe sit down initially and the mind be quite excited, and then as we calm the mind a bit, then it becomes really dull and sleepy, and then we have to heighten it back up. What we do is we put effort into bringing the mind back up, and not having it be so cloudy and fuzzy and dull, but rather increasing the sharpness of that by renewing our attention to the meditation object. Ill will, maybe this doesn't arise frequently for most of us, And we can see how this can be such an obstacle. I mean, if you've ever tried to meditate after you've had, you know, a big argument with somebody and you really have those kinds of thoughts of ill will towards them, you know that the mind doesn't settle down, right? You just keep going back to that. It's a real difficult distraction to deal with. It takes a lot of effort to overcome those kinds of thoughts. But they obviously are a major factor in some people's minds in terms of developing meditation. And so we need to apply effort to overcome that. Attachment to sense objects sounds a little similar to excitement, but here we're looking at kind of those things that we are craving that we would like to have, as opposed to things that we've had in the past that we kind of remember and recall. That's what excitement does. Here it's the idea that as you sit in meditation, you start thinking about cherry pie or something, or you start thinking about, you know, some other object, some sense object that you'd like to be experiencing. One videotape I watched on, or video on YouTube, was a meditator instructor. I was kind of curious how he presented his instruction in meditation. And one of the first statements he said is, "Meditation is really boring." And I was like, I'm glad somebody else said it. Because you don't hear instructors in this tradition say that so often. But it can be more exciting and more enticing, I think, the further you go. But initially when you sit down, it's really boring. I mean, we're used to a lot of stimulation in our lives, right? We want lights and things all happening, and, you know, look at what we're doing again in terms of video games and culture, all these kinds of things that they excite us. They give us that kind of entertainment. But when you stop the mind and you kind of like just go, okay, I'm going to focus on the breath. I'm just going to be with the breath. I'm breathing in. I'm breathing out. There's the breath. There's the breath. And it seems really boring for the mind. So again, attachment to sense objects is one way that we excite the mind, right? That we give it that kind of, oh, it would be really nice to be eating that right now. It would be really nice to hear that music or whatever. We tend to think about all the stuff that we need to experience in the future, that we want to experience when we get up off the cushion even. So again, recognize that takes some effort to overcome. And we can use some of the same antidotes, again, that we saw earlier, put some effort into thinking about how this attachment that I have arising isn't useful. It's only going to keep me from focusing the mind, calming the mind. But there's lots of antidotes to the sense objects and overcoming them. The final one is doubt. And doubt actually here means a doubt about the benefit of meditation. Which, once more, if you're finding it quite boring and finding it quite tedious, and you might sit there and go, well, why in the hell am I meditating anyway? You know, we don't really, if we're not real clear about the benefits of meditation. And that's something that, again, is not easy to get in the beginning. Because when you sit down in meditation, it's a new practice for the mind. And it's very hard to do. And it does stay somewhat hard to do, but it does become easier over time once we put that requisite amount of time in. But to have doubt about the benefits of meditation means that we just need to probably study a bit more and really read up on what we can gain by having a focused mind and put effort into overcoming that doubt through our own investigation and come to see that there will be great power to the mind. The way that concentration and wisdom are talked about sometimes in the text is this idea that the analogy that's used is, say you're in a very dark cave and all you have is a candle light to be able to see these amazing paintings that are on the cave wall. And say there's a draft in the cave so that you have the wind coming through and the light is constantly flickering. This is what our minds are like before we meditate and really calm it. The light's flickering. So do you get a good view of what's on the cave wall at all? You know, you just get little glimmers of it. You can't really do much with it because it's not steady. The ability for it to be steady is what we're trying to do with concentration. But then within that steadiness, to make the light more and more powerful. So maybe it's more like an oil lamp where we are kind of increasing the power of that. Once it's steady and we bring the illumination to the situation, then we can see everything quite clearly. But if it's never steady, it doesn't matter the strength of the flame because you're never going to be able to penetrate into, you know, seeing exactly what is there. And again, this is the relationship between our concentration and wisdom. If we can make the mind quite steady and focused, then on the basis of that, we can penetrate quite deeply and come to see things as they are. So again, doubt about what the benefits are of meditation means that we need to overcome that doubt through effort, through actually coming to see that there's great usefulness in spending our time on the cushion every day. Geshe Sherab, who is the resident Geshe in Santa Fe in the months when I'm away, we were there together for a few years, and so I would go to his teachings, and he just really always emphasizes to his students, and I try to do the same, to have a continuity to your practice. Even if you only practice for a couple of minutes on a day, say you have a really crazy day and you just didn't find time to meditate in the morning and you're getting ready for bed, I mean, at least just 5 minutes. Just sit down for 5 minutes in quiet meditation. And I think it's really useful to have some form of a focused meditation, stabilizing, you know, a meditation that's about increasing that steadiness and stability of the mind. It's useful to also have the meditation that's about wisdom and cultivating some investigation of these topics, like what you're studying this weekend. But to at least spend some time every day to have that continuity is so important. You might think, well, I meditate once a week. Well, once a week is so infrequent that there's not going to be much strength to it. If you're at least doing it once a day, if you can do it twice a day, wonderful. If you can do it more times a day, even more wonderful. And it doesn't have to be long periods of time initially, certainly. I usually recommend for beginners to do just a couple of minutes of meditation. Good enough. Maybe you even do several small increments. So you set your little timer, if you do have a meditation timer, which is useful to have. Most smartphones have some apps for doing that. Set it for every 5 minutes, and it goes off in 5 minutes, and then maybe you have like a break for a minute, and then it goes off the next 5 minutes. And then you are able to kind of break it into smaller segments of time. If you're a beginner and you sit down to meditate and you say, I'm going to meditate for an hour, well, good luck. Pema Chodron, I think in one of her teachings, she said the first time she meditated, she remembers it was a longer period, but she remembered the bell ringing at the beginning. She was in a group where they were all like, dong, and she heard this wonderful dong, and then she heard the bell ring at the end. That was all that she remembered from that period of meditation. You know, so that's going to be the case if we choose too much time. So try to choose a small increment of time. Other factors to consider in our practice of skillful effort. Effort is also thwarted by laziness, the laziness of indolence, which is the simply saying, you know, I'm not going to get on the cushion. Tomorrow I'll meditate, whatever. It's in Santa Fe, this is a bit of what we call the land of mañana. You know, I'll do it tomorrow. I'll continue to put it off. The laziness of attachment to mundane affairs. This is what I call the laziness of busyness. It means that we fill our life with so much crazy stuff that we have to do that we don't have time for our spiritual practice, for our meditation. So recognize that if you're doing that, there's time for it. You just have to rearrange your life and not be so attached to all of your worldly affairs. And then finally, the laziness of self-defeatism, where we kind of convince ourselves, oh, everyone can meditate, but I can't. Or, as Venerable Urbina said about one person, I tried meditating once and it didn't work for me. Well, you know, what did you expect? It's one period of meditation. Come on. You know, self-defeatism is telling ourselves we can't do it. The reality is we can. It just does take effort. And then, as I mentioned earlier, this is where that relinquishment comes in. Effort does depend upon four conditions or powers. This is in a more traditional Mahayana presentation. It involves aspiration, meaning that we have to have some drive to achieve a goal. It involves steadfastness, meaning seeing things through to the end, making that determination of having a continuity to our practice and so on. Joy, a really important one. If your meditation and your spiritual practice feels like it's drudgery, well, you're probably not doing it right. You need to bring joy into the practice. You need to rejoice in the things that you're able to do and give yourself, you know, those good pats on the back and what have you that keep the practice from feeling like it's all about difficulty. It is hard, but there's definitely reward. And the fourth is relinquishment. It's like making that determination at times to set the work aside, to replenish your resources so you can go back and do the work again. I mean, even in meditation retreats, they don't keep people there from the time they, you know, finish one meal till the next time that they go to the meal, and then from the time they finish that meal to the next time they go to the next meal. There's breaks. There's time for, you know, walking out in nature, doing whatever you might need to give yourself some space so that you can do the spiritual work that you need to. Wow, that was quick, but any questions? Yeah, Peter.
Hello, check.
Yeah.
I'm not sure you can. I'm not sure what you'd say about this, but that laziness of self-defeatism. Well, I'll speak for myself, unfortunately. That's one I really struggle with. I mean, it is brutal, and maybe it's because I'm just a brutal taskmaster, you know.
Need to lighten up.
It's just, yeah. I mean, but it is that one. That one. How do you? What? Any thoughts or advice on that one?
You know, I think that in my experience, acknowledging the progress that we have made is such an important part of not having that mind that says we're not good enough, we're not doing well enough, we're not meditating enough, we're not whatever enough. I mean, just to really acknowledge the ways that we have changed and have made progress already, because every one of us has, and I'm sure you have, Peter, in the time that you practice Dharma. So really rejoicing in that, being content with that, and also recognizing that there's work to be done. And so we happily put the effort into it because we can see already the results that we have from looking at where we were when before we started Dharma practice, where we are now. It's a bit like what Suzuki Roshi said to students. Apparently, he had them gathered once, and he told them, he said, "You're all perfect just as you are, and you could use a little work." You know, so, you know, we don't get the first message so frequently, though, that we're perfect as we are. We tend to say we're all imperfect and we need a lot of work, and that's the message we give ourselves. So if we rest in kind of some idea that there is a wellspring from which all of this is coming forth, and the Mahayana tradition, we call this our Buddha nature. This is sort of at the fundamental core of our being, is that, again, wellspring of all these good qualities of all of our pure, clear, focused mind, and we just are trying to bring all that to the forefront. And so there is that to rely upon, but we need the work. We need the little work to kind of keep bringing that forward. But just to really give yourself credit for the work that you've done, you know. Yeah, I don't know if I can say a whole lot more. If anyone else in the room has anything to share. Yeah, Diane.
I have read in one of the teachings, and I think it's Mahayana tradition, but not the old tradition, more current, that reading about the teachings or from the teachings is a form of meditation.
You know, I mean, when we talk about the word meditation, here it's in the context of maybe the more formal meditation where we are actually sitting in practice and trying to develop concentration of the mind. But the word meditation in Tibetan, why we call this a gompa, is the word gom has the connotation of becoming familiar with. Anything you do that helps you become familiar with the Dharma is meditation in that context. So it's just a matter of how you look at it. And again, in that larger context of what we mean by becoming familiar with the Dharma, it includes reading, it includes thinking while we're riding the bus or driving our car, thinking about the teachings that you had this weekend and digesting them. It includes so many different activities. You can even do that while you're peeling vegetables, you know. So Dharma practice in that context as meditation is much broader. In this context, it's really looking at the time that we're trying to spend in focused meditation, what we might call formal meditation. Which I don't want to make it sound like, you know, you wear a tux or anything and have to, like, get all ready in that way. It's just your time that you're dedicating to focus meditation, sitting in a chair, sitting in a cushion, whatever works for you. Yeah? Yeah, Susie?
When a thought comes up and you sort of bat it aside like it's a cloud or something. That's, okay, there goes, not
kind of
positive,
let it go.
Not negative.
Yeah.
Similarly, I do that with not being able to meditate. I say, oh, there you go again, thinking you can't meditate.
Yeah, just to let that thought be like that cloud that just goes away. You know, we don't have to buy into it. That wonderful bumper sticker and book title, don't believe everything you think. Yeah, good. Okay, so we have about 3 minutes for 2 more steps. So I'm just going to talk about mindfulness really, really quickly and use this first bullet point there. That's descriptions of mindfulness. These are 2 different descriptions that are given that come from the 2 different traditions that I've been alluding to. From this is what Alan Wallace says in his book, The Attention Revolution. So again, these are his view of these. But I would say these are probably pretty close to how the Theravadin tradition in the first comment looks at mindfulness, and then the Mahayana tradition that we practice here, the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. Mindfulness in the Theravadin tradition is a moment-to-moment, non-judgmental awareness of whatever arises. Now, again, it's not that Tibetan Buddhism would say that's wrong. They would just say that's a component of it. But moreover, mindfulness is attending continuously to a familiar object without forgetfulness or distraction. That's why we can use these terms like bodhicitta mindfulness, that we want to be bringing that to mind frequently. We want to be attending to that on an ongoing basis. So mindfulness, as Rinpoche says, and these were Light of the Path teachings some years ago, mindfulness of what? We need to have mindfulness of something. Mindfulness in and of itself isn't a goal. We all have mindfulness. It's one of the qualities of our mind. And as Rinpoche and Venerable Robina both say, even a good thief needs mindfulness. So mindfulness in and of itself is no great thing, and we've made it into something in our culture that's quite bigger than what it is. But what we want to do is know what that quality of mind is about. It's about keeping aware of what it is that we're doing, not forgetting. In meditation, it means keeping your awareness of the meditation object, that this is what you're focusing on. Or if you're doing meditation that is more analytical in nature, that that's the subject that you're investigating. But in this context of developing single-pointed concentration, it means you're not going to let go of that object. The mindfulness is going to be there, not allow you to forget it. This is a big factor in increasing our concentration. The concentration, or meditation, on the last page, page 5, is really this idea of the stable and concentrated mind that acts as a support then for deepening and enhancing our insight into the Buddha's teaching. So we can say this is another term for this is meditative stabilization. It means that we've now got the mind to a place where it is single-pointedly focused on a particular object. And we have moments of that in our meditation. What we're trying to do is extend those moments to where we have that at a very deep level. They say when you achieve a fully qualified concentrative state like this, which is what we in our tradition call calm abiding, shine, or shamatha in the Sanskrit. When you achieve that state of mind, you can remain single-pointedly focused on any object of virtue that you're meditating on for as long as you wish, with no distraction. And moreover, you have kind of a suppleness to the mind and body that are unlike anything you've had before. You can sit in meditation for as long as you want. How wonderful, you know. Many of us have physical difficulty even sitting for long periods of time. The teachings on how to develop concentration I took primarily from the way that these are set out in the Lam Rim presentation. So if you have a deeper curiosity about those, go to any of the Stages of the Path texts, and people here that are been around for a while know all these texts, and read the section on the perfection of concentration or calm abiding, sometimes called mental quiescence. I mean, there's different terminology for it. It's one of the unfortunate things. All these terms in Sanskrit or Tibetan, they've been translated into English with so many variety of terms that sometimes you need a handbook just to know what you're reading. But calm abiding, again, is to some degree a product of all of these factors that we've looked at, especially our effort and our mindfulness. But it's an absolute essential basis that we need in order to develop deeper wisdom. So as I said, this wheel that we're talking about, you know, we begin with some level of wisdom as we did when we started on Friday night, gaining an understanding of the Buddha's path, understanding that we need to have a good foundation of morality that is rooted in that understanding, the worldview that the Buddha taught, that we need to pay attention to the karma that we're creating, because that does have an influence not just on our experiences, but even on our state of mind. And on the basis of that, fine-tune the mind through these other factors that contribute to making the mind very stable and focused. That will then allow us to more deeply penetrate into the wisdom teachings. And as I said, it becomes a circle, a spiral, each of these feeding on into each other and contributing to the strength of each other. Okay, questions to conclude. I don't know that I have much more to say, since it's 4:02 according to that, maybe 4:03. Everybody's anxious to get going. Any questions? Okay, so yes, Renee, is there a microphone back there? Yeah.
Just looking at the right mindfulness.
Sure.
So the skillful mindfulness, when you say close placement, can you talk about that a little bit?
Oh, I should have probably given you at least a reference for where to find more of that. Close placement and mindfulness, this is a technique that is not that it's not used in the Mahayana tradition, but is probably more frequently an area of greater practice in the Theravadan tradition. What we are essentially doing is using a mindful awareness of these four factors of our bodies, kind of particularly, as it says there, the breath, our feelings, which are an understanding that these arisal of pleasant sensations, neutral or unpleasant sensations, are to be observed and not to be reacted to create more suffering, that the three poisons of anger, attachment, and ignorance, that we need to be aware of their arisal in the mind by focusing on a close placement of mindfulness on the mind, and then finally on phenomena, which are the other thoughts and things that arise within our mental landscape. So we could say these are three ways of practicing mindfulness by observing different objects. And what they do is they use each of these different objects, the bodies, feelings, minds, and phenomena, as doorways to help understand more deeply the teachings that the Buddha gave. So they are understanding that the Four Noble Truths, in essence, through seeing each of these four more clearly. It becomes a rather complicated topic to go into in more detail. I think there's a couple of books from the Theravadan tradition that discuss these four. Trying to think of one right now that it's not coming to mind. We do study them. Remember I talked about how the Eightfold Path is in the 37 Harmonies with Enlightenment? I did that on Friday night. That is a topic that's discussed in our tradition as part of the ornament teachings, the teachings that are in the basic program. And so the four close placements of mindfulness are also in the 37 Harmonies with Enlightenment. In fact, they're the first topic. But they are just a particular practice of working with mindfulness in regard to particular objects. Beyond that, I don't know, again, it becomes quite complicated to talk about. The four misconceptions, just real quickly, that are just below that, these are talked about by Rinpoche even in the same book I've been mentioning frequently, Bodhisattva Attitude. And that is these four misconceptions that we also want to be overcoming, kind of noted and corrected within the practice of skillful mindfulness. Our misconception of that which is impermanent as permanent, of that which is suffering as happiness, that which is impure as pure, and that which is selfless as actually having a self. These sound a bit familiar to the four seals that we looked at earlier, right? The only difference being this impure as pure. And this is our mistaken idea that the body is somehow pure. Primarily, this is the one that we get trapped in. You know, bodies are not that pure if we really investigate. So, any other questions? Thanks for bringing that up. But all right. Well, I hope this has been helpful. And my suggestion for you would be, if you feel, you know, moved by these teachings to some degree, is to maybe look back over the notes, the outlines that I've given you, and maybe find one or two places that you'd like to start. I mean, obviously, those of you who feel like you maybe don't have everything involved in right view yet because you're fairly new to Buddhism might need to focus there. Maybe you want to strengthen your intention or motivation, so you might see some things there that would be worth investigating, meditating on, thinking about. Others might be wanting to address things in terms of morality or wanting to just use these tools we've just barely touched on in regard to meditation and concentration. But just know that all three of these are really quite essential to any Buddhist path. And the Eightfold Path, I hope this has again been of some benefit to give you some context for how to look at spiritual practice in whatever tradition that we're practicing. So let's do a few dedication prayers then to conclude. Let's do that really nice one that we did at the end of the morning teachings, if everyone's okay with that, page 246. This is this wonderful prayer from Master Shantideva from his 10th chapter of his text. And bring to mind, as you recite this, any beings that you specifically want to dedicate for as well, that you'd like to make sure that they experience some benefit from our work here this weekend. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power, and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. Then turn the page back to 244, recite these two prayers, and I suggested this morning as well, you know, to just have these thoughts of, we're not just making prayers for the good health and long lives of these two precious teachers, but we're making prayers for the good health and long lives of all of our spiritual guides, all those who are helping ourselves and others to find true peace and happiness. In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. All-powerful Chenrezig Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. You who uphold the subduer's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjunath's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplish magnificent prayers honoring the three jewels, Savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. And thank you all so much for the opportunity to be here with you for this weekend. And I again hope it's of some benefit. So thanks.